The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Everybody spends a lot of time hearing about, thinking about, learning about Shabbat. And people don't always stop to experience what we call Erev Shabbat, the eve of Shabbat. And you find very often in Judaism that the preparation for an experience is as important and as valuable as the experience itself. And so Friday is your opportunity really to prepare for Shabbat. It's not accidental we're going to take a tour in Mea Shearim, because among other things, one of the things that I can't explain and I'm not even sure I can describe is that you get to see how Yerushalayim prepares for Shabbat. So consider this discussion, this class that we're going to have together now, this hour, a preparation for our preparation for Shabbat. And in preparation for our preparation tour for Shabbat, so I want to tell you a story that I once heard from Shlomo. And I'll tell you something that helped me to understand the story of Rav Shlomo. So now we're on an introduction to an introduction to an introduction to an introduction to Shabbat. When my wife was pregnant with Yonatan, our second. We have three children, Baruch Hashem. So, you know, the first child, so you're all nervous. I mean, we had a bag packed in the front hall, I don't know, it must have been a month and a half before she gave birth. And, you know, we went to Lamaz, and I read every pregnancy book imaginable. Then the second pregnancy, you know, you get a little cocky, you know, yeah, you have to worry about it. So it was about 5 weeks before she was due, and she had actually been, she gave birth to Mayana, our eldest, 2 weeks late. So this was the farthest thing from my mind. And she was actually in the industrial section in Yerushalayim. She was taking her boss's car to the garage as a favor to him because she had to do something there. And she calls me up from this area. She says, listen, I'm on my way to the garage. I'm with my mom, my mother-in-law. And I think my water broke. But I'm not sure. Now, I have no idea as a man what that means. I don't know how you could not be sure, but this is what she says. I'm not sure, but you know what? Maybe you better, you know, get some stuff together and pick up the kids and come to Yerushalayim. Worst comes to worst, so it's nothing, but you know. Now, you can't say that to a husband a month before you give birth. So she, and I'm like, oh, okay, you know, probably nothing, but sure, no problem, dear, you know. Ever see the cartoon? So I start throwing things into a bag and I run out to the car and it's not there. Because she had lent it to our boss, to her boss, while she was taking his car to the garage. So I have to call her boss and he has to come get me and I have to get the kids. And I go herring into Yerushalayim. And I finally get to Yerushalayim and I go to my in-laws apartment because they had made Aliyah. And she's like sitting in the living room, just like they're all laughing and smoking. You know, I come in with the kids. I thought, listen, no, we don't know, but maybe whatever, you know, bag, clothes sticking out, everything. You know, I forgot the pillow and whatever, the lollipops, whatever else you need for. And we come running in and then she's sitting like, oh, hi, how you doing? Yeah. Oh, no, I don't know. I mean, maybe my water broke, maybe it didn't, I don't know. Maybe we should just sit here. I said, listen, 4 o'clock in the afternoon now. I just came here and in. We're going to go to the hospital. Worst comes to worst, we go to the hospital for nothing, right? So she thinks maybe it's silly, but her father agrees. You know, he's a doctor. He says, no, you know what, you should go, check it out. What do you have to lose? So we leave the kids with them. I figured, all right, we'll go for a romantic drive, you know, out to the hospital. And we get to the hospital. And she, on the way to the hospital, starts to feel a couple of contractions just as we get into a traffic jam. And I said, you know, maybe it's good we're going to the hospital. But then they kind of disappear. We get to the hospital, to Hadassah, Harat Safim, and we get up to the obstetrics ward, wherever it is, and out comes a nurse who, in another incarnation, must have been a Marine sergeant. And she comes out, and, you know, my wife says, listen, you know, contractions, the water broke. I think maybe whatever. She looks at her, she goes, no, shum davar. No, nothing. So I says, look, you know, I don't know, whatever. She goes, Tov, at rotza bdika, you want to check? Now, from what little I know, most women do not want to answer yes to that question, but I guess under the circumstances. So she says, okay, yes, you know, check. Gives me a look like, why am I doing this? Gets checked out. The Marine sergeant says, nope, you're like only 3 centimeters dilated. Go walk around, go home, come back later. So we walk out and I said, listen, you know, there was traffic. I don't want to go home. Let's stick around for a few hours. We'll see if it's nothing. So we'll go home, whatever. You know, I've read all the stories about people who have 40-hour labors, people who have 1-hour labors, whatever. We have our bags already. So we walk around the hospital. About 20 minutes later, my wife says, you know, I'm going to give birth. Now, she wasn't in agony, and nothing's going on. I said, no, no, no. Right, the husband, right, thank you. No, 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 you're not going to give birth because you know, it's going to be centimeters. And she said, it'll be hours. She says, no, 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 no. We should go back. I'm going to give birth. And I start to argue. I start to say, no, the nurse said, you know, the nurse checked you, whatever. And I said, you know, this is dumb. So we go back. Hour and a half later, we had a baby boy. Now, I do not understand this to this day. There was no reason that she should have done this, but she did. And I tell you that to explain to you the following story. This story I heard from Shlomo Kalbach. Shlomo Kalbach told me he was once giving a concert. And this is years ago. And there was a very well-to-do couple. They were sitting right center in the front row in what were, I guess, expensive seats. Very nicely dressed, very aristocratic. But they were incredibly into this concert. He was giving a Jewish music concert, and they were singing, and you could see they wanted to jump up and dance. And he noticed something strange, and they were like in their, you know, I guess early 40s. They kept hugging each other during the concert. Like, you don't normally see that, you know, aristocratic, nice, calm, you know. And they're just hugging each other, and they're singing, whatever. And they caught his eye, I guess, because they were in the front. So after the concert, they were still hanging around. They were obviously still into it. So he walked over to them, and he said, you know, maybe you could help me out and give me a ride home, you know, because he wanted to get to know who they were. So they said, oh, wonderful, yeah, sure, we can sing, you know, it's great, right? We'll get in the car. So he says to them, you know, who are you? Where are you from? I noticed you were so into it every time I sang a song. That's so wonderful. So the woman says to the husband, you tell a story. The husband says, no, no, you tell a story. So he realizes, of course, there's a story. So she says, look, I'll tell you our story. She says, we got married late. And they told us we couldn't have children. But I got pregnant. And the pregnancy lasted for 6 months. And we lost the baby. Had to abort. And the doctor said, you'll never be able to have children. You should look into adopting. For whatever the reasons. But I was able to get pregnant again. And this time the pregnancy went to the 7th month. And then one morning I didn't feel well. And whatever happened. And I went to the doctor. And the doctor said, look, I told you you're not going to be able to have children. In a few hours you're going to lose this baby. She says, I walked out of his office. I thought the world was falling out of me. I didn't know what I was going to do. And I'm walking around and I'm thinking, do I want to live? Why do I want to bother? And I happened to walk by a synagogue. A shul. And it was a Friday morning. And there were some men coming out of the synagogue. They had obviously been praying or something. So I figured, I'm Jewish. I'll walk into the synagogue. I haven't had much to do with Judaism. I don't remember much about Judaism. So she walks into the synagogue. And it's open and nobody asks or whatever. And she walks into the main sanctuary. This big ark. Aron. And she walks up to the ark. And she says, you know, God, I haven't talked to you in a long time. She says, I don't even know if you're listening. But I want this baby so much. Don't let me lose this baby. And she starts to cry. This is what she's telling Shlomo Kalbach. And she says, I don't know how long I stood there. And I cried and I prayed. And I said, you know, it's Friday. And I remember when I was a little girl, my grandmother used to light Shabbos candles. And my mother never really lit them. And I've never lit Shabbos candles. She says, give me this child and I will light Shabbos candles every Friday for the rest of my life. And I will teach my child the beauty of Shabbos candles. Shabbos candles, such an easy mitzvah, such a beautiful mitzvah to take two candles to light them. Wonderful. What could be wrong with giving light to the world? She walks out of that shul and she feels this tremendous sense of joy because she's convinced that Hashem has heard her and has answered her prayers. Now, I'll be honest with you, when I first heard this story, I did not understand this part of the story. I heard this from Rav Shlomo Kalbach. It wasn't like I read it somewhere when he came to Efrat once. It took me a long time to understand it. But that's how she felt. Now it was Friday. And she made a deal. And in her perception, Hashem had said, you're going to be able to have this child. But she had said, I'm going to light candles. She had no idea how to light candles, what to do with candles, where to get candles. She didn't know what to do. So she knew this woman, sort of a friend, an acquaintance who was a religious, whatever that means, woman, but who she imagined lit Shabbat candles. So she called her up. Said, listen, you know, whatever, I decided I want to start lighting Shabbos candles. Told her the story. I promised I'm going to light Shabbos candles, you know. So the woman said, well, you know, if you want to light Shabbos candles. And by the way, I'm telling you a story. I'm not telling you an opinion. So the woman said, if you want to light Shabbos candles, You can't light Shabbos candles in your house on Friday afternoon and give your family pork to eat on Friday night. It's a big decision. You sure you want to do it? If you want to light Shabbos candles and you want it to mean something, how can you light Shabbos candles on Friday afternoon and then serve pork for dinner? She says 2 hours later, the whole kitchen was trashed. She bought new dishes, everything. Kosher home. And the woman says, you know, because she goes over and they get candles, she says, you know, you want to have a Shabbos, a Friday night, and a dinner. How can you do it if your husband doesn't want to share Shabbos with you? What is Shabbos if you have Shabbos alone? She calls up her husband. Now it's an hour before Shabbos. She says to him, we have 3 huge stores. From now on, you are going to keep Shabbos. If you don't, we're getting a divorce. She hangs up the phone. Within an hour, the guy's home. She says, 3 months later, she gave birth to a baby boy. And she's never stopped lighting Shabbos candles on Friday afternoon. What is the power of Shabbat? So you think the story's over? The story's not over. It's never over, the film. He says he hadn't been back in this particular city, in this place, for a few years. And he found himself back in that same area. I think it was in Canada, but I might be wrong. And he remembered this woman. He had his book or whatever it was. And so he gave her a call. He said, you know, I'm back, whatever. I may be a story. I wanted to come. Maybe we could spend some time together. I'm going to be here for Shabbos. Oh, I'm so glad you called. It was a Tuesday afternoon. She says, you have to come to my house. I have to show you something. So he says, okay. So it's Tuesday night. And he gets to her house. And she's so excited. And they're a very wealthy family with a huge home, many rooms. They go from, you know, the entranceway to the hallway to the vestibule to the next room, whatever. She said, I want to show you the 2 most special rooms in my house. So they go upstairs and they go to one of the rooms. And inside the room, it's dark. And you can hear the sound of breathing. And there are 3 children in 3 beds. They have 3 children. She says, wow, you know, if you've ever heard of Shlomo speak, you can imagine a Shlomo Kalbach walking into a family's home and seeing sleeping children at night, Gibbah. And I know for me, when my children are asleep, there's something very precious about being with your child when they're asleep, when they're so pure. And they wake up, but okay. And he's looking at them, and he's giving them a bracha, whatever else they're doing. He says, sir, tell me, you have such a huge house, and you have so many rooms. He said, how come all 3 children, there's a bunk bed, the other room is in a corner, how come all 3 children are in one room? So she looks at him like he doesn't get it. She says, well, when you light Shabbos candles, you don't light a Shabbos candle in one room and another Shabbos candle in another room. Candles need to be lit together. They need to give to each other and feed off of each other. So I want my children to grow up in the same room. She says, but I'll show you my 2nd favorite room in the house. They go back downstairs into the dining room. It's Tuesday night. And there's a candelabra set up. And there are 5 candles. You know, there's a custom, light an additional candle for each child. So he looks at her. It's Tuesday night. She says, when we had our 2nd child, I decided we were going to start setting up the candles for the next Shabbos as soon as this Shabbos was over. What's the power of a Shabbos candle? So you think the story's over? The story's not over. A year later, Shlomo Kalbach gets a letter in the mail. And the letter, from someone whose name he doesn't recognize, starts out, Mazel Tov. It's a little strange, you know. He didn't know anything Mazel Tov in his life. She says, you don't know me, but you told a story about me at a concert you gave almost a year ago. And she reminds him, you told a story about a woman who couldn't give birth, Shabbos candles. She says, we had 5 miscarriages. And I was in the middle of my 6th pregnancy. And the doctors told me I wasn't going to be able to do it, but I wouldn't give up. And you can imagine how much stress. And we decided to come to this concert. And my husband came with me. And for whatever reason, we had a couple of friends. They said, you should come. It's nice, whatever. And I heard this story. And it blew me away. So I turned to my husband. And I said, listen, this is an incredible story. My husband said, yeah, it's an incredible story. She says to him, that's it. We have to start lighting Shabbos candles. Now, I don't know what the reaction of the husband is, because I'm telling you from a letter, from a story that I heard from a Shlomo Kalbach, 2nd person, but I imagine he understood what she was saying. So she continues the letter, Mazel Tov, it's a baby girl. What is Shabbat? What's it meant to be? am I supposed to make of it? And I want to tell you, you know, we don't have that much time, but I want to give you a piece of food for thought. Recognizing that there are different levels and perspectives that are sitting in this room, I want to ask you a couple of questions. And I want to see if we can walk away with a direction. Not just an abstract about Shabbat, but an idea that makes a difference to me every time I have Shabbos. And I'll tell you when this thought process that I'm going to share with you first hit me. It was the first time that I was an officer in Lebanon that I had to do patrol on Shabbat. And you know, I grew up in a traditional home, and whatever that means. But I had never ridden in a car on Shabbat. And I had never written on Shabbat. And I had never used the phone on Shabbat. And you know, each person has their challenges. Some people grow up without any perception of Shabbat and their challenge is to find it. Some people grow up with it as a given and their challenge is to give it meaning. But it never occurred to me, personally, to get into a car on Shabbat. And all of a sudden here I find myself in the army. And I have to get in an armored personnel carrier. And I have to write down radio coordinates. And I have to answer the radio. And I have to start a Jeep. And I have to use my flashlight. And I even have to light a fire for a roadblock. I can't tell you how difficult it was. I felt like somebody pulled the rug right out of me. Where was Shabbos? It can't be, on the one hand, that Shabbat is only the ritual. Because even if you pull that away, there's still something incredible about Shabbat. What is that? How do I capture that? How do I find that? At the same time, sometimes it seems as though the ritual gets in the way. As if we get so stuck on whether or not I'm carrying a handkerchief out of my house or writing two words in a pen that it doesn't make any sense. And I'll tell you one last thought. I don't usually tell this many stories at one shot, but it's Erev Shabbos, so I'm in the mood. I remember one Friday night I was supposed to go to an oneg. I was supposed to teach a class, whatever, late Friday night, and I wanted to look up a source. And this particular sefer, this particular book was in my study. And Baruch Hashem, I have a lot of books, but I hadn't left the light on. We have a Shabbos clock. We set the lights. The light in my study wasn't on. So I couldn't find the book. So what did I do? So I walked into my study, right? And I picked up a whole pile of books. And I walked back out of the study. And I took a look, you know, and it wasn't there. And I put it back. And then I took another pile of books. And I walked out of the study. And I looked at it and it wasn't there. And this took me about 15, 20 minutes. And I finally found the book. And I was sweating. And I'd gotten my good exercise for the night. And why wasn't I doing... Well, why was I doing this? Why wasn't I just turning on the light? Well, because the verse says, Lo taseh kol melacha. You're not supposed to do any work on Shabbat. So it makes no sense. What does work mean? How does work work? If the verse says, Shesh etemim ta'avod v'asita kol melachtecha, 6 days you work and you do your labor. V'yom ha-shvi'i Shabbat l'Hashem elokecha, the seventh day is a day somehow to Hashem, to God. Lo taseh kol melacha, don't do any work. So that must mean that everything that I somehow traditionally don't do on Shabbat is work. I never saw anybody get up in the morning, right, and say, I'm going to do my calisthenics, right? That's just not how we work. So what is this? What's this perception of Shabbat? And in order to give you an idea, I want to ask you just a couple of questions. There's a very strange paragraph in the book of Exodus, in the parsha known as Vayakel, which is right in the middle of all the discussions about the Mishkan, about the tabernacle. You know, after the sin of the golden calf, Moshe built with the people, with the Talel, a tabernacle. There's a very strange line. Right in the middle of this whole building of the Mishkan, right, Moshe stops all the work. I mean, there are four whole sections, really four and a half, in the book of Exodus. The portion of Terumah, the portion of Tzaveh, the portion of Vayakel, the portion of Pekudei. Four whole sections listing all the building and the details and what they brought and how they put it together and how much it was and how they built and what the measurements and where every different vessel went and how every vessel was built. And in the middle of this whole complex description, which is difficult to understand, all of a sudden Moshe stops it all. And you have this picture of Moshe saying, everybody, slow down. Vayakel Moshe et kol adat bnei Israel. And Moshe gathers together the entire people of Israel. And according to the Bible, that's 600,000 men from the army, is the time that they counted them. So that must be a few million people when you count together everybody else. And he says to them, Vayomer Alehem, Eile hadvarim asher tziva Hashem la'asot otam. These are the things that God commanded us to do. Now what do I expect to hear from Moshe? At this point, expecting to hear, listen, you guys are building a Mishkan. This is tremendous. We're building a tabernacle. We're going to put the menorah over here. We're going to put the altar over there. And then we're going to have a big ceremony and we're going to offer sacrifice. It's going to be incredible. No, that's not what Moshe says. He says, these are the words that God said to do. Sheishet yamim taseh melacha. 6 days you shall labor. Uvayom ha-shavi'i yelachem kodesh shabbat shabbaton la'ashem. And on the seventh day, it will be for you a day of kedusha, of sanctity to God. That's a very difficult question. What does the word kedusha, sanctity, mean? Holiness. We use that word all the time. I'll give you the Jewish perception of what kedusha is. The definition of kedusha is coming closer to God. That's what holiness is in Judaism. Something that brings me closer to Hashem is holy. And something that pushes me further away is unholy. Love, therefore, is holy. Because when I love my fellow human being, I come closer to Hashem. Hatred, therefore, is unholy. This day is a day of holiness. It's a day to come closer. And to come closer to everything that brings you closer to Hashem. What is this doing in the middle of the building of the Mishkan? Doesn't make any sense. So, Rashi was one of the greatest commentators we ever had, 1040 to 1105, Ashkenaz commentator. He died at the age of 65. He wrote a commentary on the entire Bible, on all of the prophets, on the entire Talmud, in addition to a number of other works that are less known. And he is probably the most quoted commentary in the last 1,000 years in Judaism. And Rashi says an incredible thing. He says, you might have thought that if you're building a Mishkan, if you're building a tabernacle for God, that you don't need to stop on Shabbat. I mean, what's the whole reason that I stop my labor of the week for Shabbat? I guess, well, we'll see, but somehow, because it pulls me away from my relationship to God, maybe, so I take a day and I remember what it's all about and I come closer to God. But here I'm building a tabernacle. I'm building a Mishkan. So if I'm building a tabernacle to God, then obviously I don't have to stop that type of building for Shabbat. So therefore, Moshe comes along and says Rashi, he's actually basing himself on the Talmud, no, even for a Mishkan, you have to stop. Even if you're building a tabernacle to God, you have to stop the building for Shabbat. So now that's a very interesting question. The first question is, why? Why can't you build the Mishkan on Shabbat? And why would the Jews assume that you could? And that's something that Rashi doesn't answer. The Abarbanel, who talks about this, he doesn't answer it either. In fact, to the best of my knowledge, I haven't found a commentary yet, I'm sure they're there, who really relates to this. Why? That's my first question. And I want you to understand there is a truth, there is a depth regarding Shabbat that's contained in this short paragraph that is magnificent. I'll ask you a second question. But I'll share something very interesting with you. On Shabbat morning, you know, we have a number of different prayers on Shabbat. We have the Friday night prayer, we have the Shabbat morning prayers, and we have the Shabbat afternoon prayers, right? In the Shabbat morning prayer, in the Shacharit service, so the central part of the prayer is what we call the Silent Amidah, the Shemoneh Esrei, right? Which are traditionally 18, they've since become 19 because of the times of the Talmud, they added one, prayers. But on Shabbat, in fact, I break down those prayers and I substitute some of them that I only say during the week. That's another discussion. And I really end up saying 7 prayers. And the core of these blessings, of these 7 blessings, are the blessings that I say specifically for Shabbat. The middle blessing. And it's very interesting that you will see that there is a different middle blessing on Friday night than there is Shabbat morning, than there is Shabbat afternoon. Just as an example, on Shabbat afternoon we say, Ata Echad. You are one. V'shimcha echad, and your name is one. U'mi ke'amcha Yisrael goy echad ba'aretz. And who is like your people Israel? One nation. It's as if the whole theme of Shabbat, the flow of Shabbat, is supposed to bring me finally on Shabbat afternoon, which is the prayer I say before the sunset, to the idea of unity. Unity with Hashem, unity with myself, unity with my fellow human being. In fact, the end of that prayer, the world is one. And so you can also sense a theme from these different prayers. So interesting to me is the prayer of Shacharit, of Shabbat morning. And part of that prayer, it says, and some of you may recognize the words, Ushnei luchot avanim, horid biyado. And he with his own hands did bring down two tablets of stone. Who are we talking about? Moshe. And when are we talking about? Ten Commandments, right? Sinai. And then it continues, V'chein katuk v'toratecha. And so it says in your Torah. And you see in this prayer that it's saying that Moshe actually brought the mitzvah of Shabbat down with him at Sinai. And so it says, now this is interesting, because when the prayer says that, I would expect a quote from where? Where would be the obvious place to quote Shabbat in the context of that prayer? The Ten Commandments, right? And that's what it should say. It should say, as it says, Zachor et Yom HaShabbat LaKadsho. Remember the Shabbat day to keep it holy. Or it should say, Shamor et Yom HaShabbat LaKadsho. Keep, whatever that means, the Shabbat day to keep it holy. Now I have to give you an aside here before I get back to my question. Why do I say that it might say one of two things? Because it's interesting to note that in the Bible, the Ten Commandments are repeated twice. Once in the book of Exodus, and once in the book of Deuteronomy. Once in Shemot, once in Dvarim. It's interesting that when you look at the second set of Ten Commandments, the words are different. That's very strange. Moshe repeats the Ten Commandments to the Jewish people, again, before they enter the land of Israel. And he repeats all the Ten Commandments, except he gets some of the word wrong. And he says, Shamor et Yom HaShabbat LeKadsho. Keep the Sabbath day to make it holy. And you kind of wonder to yourself, what happened? But Moshe, like, he forgot? And I can understand, he's an old man, 120, it's been 40 years. He's been in the desert, you know, I say, forgot. Well, one word, what's the big deal? You can imagine that doesn't make a lot of sense. To forget the wording of the Ten Commandments? And if he did forget it, I'd expect God to come down from heaven, that was remember. Hey, you want to fix that up there. But God doesn't do that. And if you're looking at the Bible from the perception that I shared with you yesterday, so then if the book is written in a divine fashion, so then it's actually God who's telling Moshe to say the Ten Commandments differently. So what's going on? So I'll give you a perception in order to explain my question. Interestingly enough, the second set of Ten Commandments are in the book of Deuteronomy. The book of Deuteronomy, Sefer Dvarim, which literally is the book of words. Eile ha-dvarim asher diber Moshe. These are the words that Moshe spoke to the Jewish people, me'ever la-yarden, on the banks of the river Jordan. And the rabbis tell us that the entire book of Dvarim, almost the entire book of Dvarim, was said by Moshe in one day. And it was his farewell speech to the Jewish people. They arrive at the Jordan River already in the book of Numbers. And Moshe is told that he's not going to go with his people into the land of Israel. The place that he's been longing to go to for 40 years. The land that he's brought the Jewish people out of Egypt, that he's wandered the desert for, he doesn't get to go in. Tragic figure, Moshe. And so he gives a soliloquy, a farewell speech to the Jewish people. And it must have been a very difficult thing for him to do. What's fascinating is that he gives this farewell speech to the second generation. The first generation got out of Egypt. There was a big boo-boo, big mistake. The sin of the spies, golden calf. They didn't get into the land of Israel. The generation that came out of Egypt, at least the generation of adults, die in the desert. That's why they wandered for 40 years. They don't get to enter the promised land. They're not ready. They can't get Mitzrayim out of them, get Egypt out of them, even though they've gotten out of Egypt. It's the second generation that will enter the land. And Moshe is speaking to the second generation before they go into the land of Israel. When you appreciate that, by the way, it gives you a whole different perception of the book of Dvarim and the book of Deuteronomy. Because Moshe is saying to the next generation, you know, your parents, they grew up in the shtetl. They had a long beard. And they made kiddush every Friday night, and they lit Shabbat candles, and they had it all. But they didn't get to do what you're going to do. But realize that as you go in, you're going in for them. It's a very powerful idea. As a matter of fact, tonight,
when you daven the Kabbalat Shabbat, look at the end of the first prayer. The first prayer, the Lechunu Lanana, has such a strange ending. This is the first prayer, the psalm that I say, which was actually put together in the time of the Talmud, and the mystics used to say it in Tzfat in the 1500s, Shlomo Alkabet, the author of Lachadadi. What's the first prayer that I say to bring Shabbat in? I would think that that would be some sort of an expression of the joy of Shabbat. No. Arba'im shana akut bedor. For 40 years I tired, I nagged this generation. Va'omar am toy levavhem. And I said they were a generation of wandering hearts. Behem lo yadu d'rachai, and they didn't understand my ways. Asher nishbati v'api. And I did swear in my anger. Im yivaun el menuchati, lest they come to the land of my resting place. In other words, this is a description of the fact that the Jewish people were to wander the desert for 40 years, but that they would not get to enter the land of Israel. Why do I begin Shabbos with that? Such a negative thing. And that's how I begin. And everybody, you know, they all sing it. You know, singing Arba'i, you know, Rav Shlomo Kalbach has a magnificent nigun. And I was privileged to, he used to come to Efrat for Shabbat. We would share Shabbat with him. And he'd go up in front of the bima, and he had sometimes his chassidim with him. And there would be like a hum as he began his Kabbalat Shabbat. And he sang the whole thing from start to finish. And he had this magnificent nigun. And you see all the chassidim, they're all starting to sing, and then they start to dance. What are they dancing? Oh, 40 years, they wandered to the desert, we didn't let them in. It's a strange thing! What does it mean? It means that that 40 years was a process of education. It means that for 40 years, one generation, knowing, because they were told in the second year that they would not enter the land of Israel, actually had the faith to give over their message to the next generation. And Moshe says to them, know that when you walk into the land of Israel, you take the entire generation before you with you on your shoulders. There's a phenomenal Talmudic discussion. It's in Baba Batra, I believe it's on Daf Kuf Tet Zayin, on the 116th folio. It says, imagine for a moment that there are two men entering the land of Israel, two sons. And they get out of Egypt, and they're each supposed to get a portion in the land of Israel. We'll call them Yankel and Shmerel. When I was a kid learning in yeshiva, every example was about Yankel and Shmerel. I never knew who they were, but okay. So they both get out of Egypt, they're both supposed to get a portion of the land of Israel. But no, never, they don't get in. Because of the sin of the spies, the golden calf, so the children get in. Now Yankel has one son, and Shmerel has five sons. So now the question is, what happens when they get into the land of Israel? Do I say that those same two portions still go equally to those two sets of children? So one son gets a big, nice, fat portion. And the five sons, they have to divide the same portion into five. Or do I say no? I redo all the portions. And I give each of those six children six equal portions. That's what the Talmud wants to know. So the Talmud gives an answer. It's an incredible answer. You know why it's an incredible answer? Because like many answers in Talmud, it makes absolutely no sense. Talmud says, here's what you do. You take one portion from each of the two original sons, and you divide it into three. And then you take those three and three, which are now six, and you give five portions to the five sons, and one portion to the one son. Why does that make no sense? You understand what I just said? Right? I take two portions, I divide them up into six, and then I give one equal portion to each son. Why does that make no sense? Because I haven't solved the problem. It just means that I give portions to the six sons instead of based on the one son. Right? That's what I'm doing. So why does the Talmud say it that way? The Talmud adds a line. Shemeitim yorshim chayim. Because the dead inherit the living. And the commentary say an incredible thing. Even though I'm giving an equal portion to each person who enters the land, even though there was tremendous significance to entering the land of Israel, to being able to put it on the line for the land of Israel, you have to realize that when you enter the land of Israel, you do not enter alone. You enter with 3,000 years of history attached to your belt. A powerful idea. You sit here in this room, not because you alone decided to come here when you stop to think about it. I sit here teaching, not because I decided I wanted to teach, but because for the last 3,000 years, our ancestors have done whatever they've done to get us here. That's an awesome perception. And that's why when I start Shabbat on Friday night, I say, you know, there was a generation of Jews that for 40 years wandered the desert. I never let them in. But you are still celebrating Shabbat. You know why? Because of them. Because for 40 years, they succeeded in inculcating the beauty of Shabbat to their children. Even though they knew they would never get to taste what we will taste. They would never see a Shabbat in Yerushalayim, even though they tasted Sinai. But they gave that beauty over to their children. So in the second book, in the second commandment, it says Shamor, guard it well. Shmirah is to guard. Hang on to what you were given. Don't lose it. So that's magnificent. So now I understand. And it's interesting that the Talmud says, and we say this actually at the end of the as a part of the Lecha Dodi, Shamor v'zachor b'dibur echad. Right? Moshe is repeating the Ten Commandments. So he's telling the second generation what God said at Sinai. Well, now, after all, God either said Zachor, remember, or he said Shamor. Which one did he say? Some said, no, he said both. Now, we can't comprehend that. How can the sound of two words be said in the same sound? But we can't comprehend God, so it doesn't matter. But both those ideas, Zachor, the positive perception of Shabbat, Shamor, hanging on to it, both of those are part of Shabbat. So now I'm back to my morning prayer. In my morning prayer on Shabbat, and Moshe brought down two tablets. And so it says, Ten Commandments. Tell me Zachor. Tell me Shamor. Remember the Sabbath day. Guard it. No. You know what it quotes me? It quotes me actually what we say for Kiddush on Shabbat morning, which is how I know this is a very important quote. Vishamru b'nei sol ta Shabbat. And the Jewish people did keep, did celebrate Shabbat. Lasot ta Shabbat, to make Shabbat. And this is not in Yitro, which is the portion that the Jewish people received the Torah at Sinai. And it's not in Va'et Hanan, which is the portion in Deuteronomy that Moshe speaks to the Jewish people again. It's in Kitisa, which is actually the portion wherein appears the sin of the golden calf. What is Vishamru? What is this verse doing on Shabbat morning as a quote about Moshe giving down Shabbat? So now I want to tell you a very deep idea. And I want to tell you that this idea is special to me for two reasons. First of all, because this thought process that I'm sharing with you, I have every Shabbat morning when I make Kiddush. And if there is one thing that I'm trying to communicate to my children about Shabbat, it is this idea. And second of all, because I first came across this idea and studied this idea on a tank on a hill overlooking Beirut and Lebanon because of the thought process that I was going through that I described to you before. So Torah that you learn in a place like that has to stay special forever. So I'll tell you what I think this means. The verse that I just quoted you, Vishamru b'nei Yisrael Shabbat, la'asot et ha-Shabbat, and the Jewish people did keep or did celebrate Shabbat, to do Shabbat, it makes no sense. There's an extra part of that phrase that doesn't make sense. It should just say, Vishamru b'nei Yisrael Shabbat, the Jewish people celebrated Shabbat. Why does it say they celebrated Shabbat? To make Shabbat. So I'll tell you what I think it means. You can do with it what you want. We think, sometimes, that we're given something. And we just have to learn to take it. I'm given a Torah. You know, the Mishnah in Ethics of the Fathers says that the world is based on three things. Shimon HaTzadik, who was one of the last men of the Great Assembly, lived at the beginning of the Second Temple period. He says, the world is based on three things. Torah, Torah study, Avodah, service, prayer, Gemilut Chasadim, acts of loving kindness. And that's his whole system of Judaism. And it's interesting, I once read a commentary, Torah is something that comes down from heaven. You can't affect it. It affects you. Avodah, prayer, is what you're given the opportunity to send back up to heaven. And you actually somehow, this is a longer discussion we're actually going to have next week, have the ability to affect heaven with your prayer. That's a tremendous idea. So the first Torah is God affecting me. And the second prayer is me affecting God. What's chesed? Chesed is me affecting my fellow human beings. So we think very often that things are of the nature of Torah. Something's given to me. I just have to take it. Decide what I'm going to do with it. It's not always true. I think what that verse is saying is that the Jewish people kept Shabbat. La'asot et ha-Shabbat. They understood that Shabbat is what you make of it. It's not that there's a given. that there's some mystical formula. You can make Shabbat whatever you want to make it. And I want you to know the discovery that I made sitting on that tank in Lebanon was that Shabbat isn't about Kiddush. It's not about candles. It's not about do this or don't do that. Those are very important things. They're magnificent. They fit into a pattern. Once you realize what that pattern is, that's incredible. But really, Shabbat can be anything and anywhere. You can celebrate Shabbat on a tank. You can celebrate Shabbat anywhere in the world. My brother went on March of the Living, something that I want to do. Maybe Bezrat Hashem, one day I'll do. Maybe one day I'll get a group together from Israelite who wants to go, and we'll go. But March of the Living is a trip to Poland, Eastern Europe. My brother had the privilege of going when he was in high school. And he told me, he came back and he took slides and he showed us, the family, the slides. And he said the most powerful impression that he had, the thing that made the single most powerful impression on him, was not Auschwitz. It wasn't Treblinka. It wasn't Majdanek. He says, a guy took them around the Warsaw Ghetto. And they saw the mound that was the bunker of Mila 18. And there's a huge statue to Mordechai Analevitz, the leader of the resistance in the Warsaw Ghetto. He says the person who took them around actually had been in the Warsaw Ghetto. He was a survivor. He was a fighter. And at one point, he tells them, look around. What do you see? And nobody saw what he wanted them to see. He said, look down. There was a little sewer there, a little manhole. And he picks out this metal, whatever, tool, and he pries open the manhole cover. He says, I lived down there for 2 weeks. He says, I want each of you to get on the ground and to put your head in there. Just put your head in there for a minute. My brother said it was his turn. He thought he was going to be sick. He said that the smell that came out of the sewer, the reek, the stench, so he almost passed out. This guy lived there for 2 weeks. And the guy said, you know what else? He says, I celebrated Shabbos in that sewer. And my brother said they looked at this guy like he was from a different planet. And he said, you know what else? He said it was the most magnificent Shabbos I ever had. Could you imagine? He couldn't sing. He had no light to see a sidur by. He was just alone in a sewer. And the Nazis up top were looking at him, trying to find him, like a rat. And he was desperately hoping to escape. But in that sewer, on a Friday night, without moving an inch, he escaped. He was out of their reach. They couldn't touch him. They couldn't catch him. They couldn't put a net around him. Because he brought Shabbat into that sewer. That is such a powerful image. La'asot et ha-Shabbat. That's what we say every Shabbat morning. You know what Moshe gave us when he came down from Sinai? He didn't just give us a tool. He empowered us to make the given day into Shabbat. What does that mean? I remember when I was a kid, my mother's English. So we used to go to England in the summers. And in the summer in England, Shabbat comes in, you know, sunset, the stars, at 10:30 at night sometimes. My brother and I told you we grew up traditional, my older brother and I, were three. And we always wanted to see what it was like to go out to the movies on Friday night. You know, it was like one of those things, you know, come back home, tell our friends, yeah, I went to the movies Friday night. So we convinced my parents, you know, that we were going to go to the movies Friday night. So, you know, there was like an early Shabbat prayer service, because, you know, most families, they don't want to daven 11 o'clock at night, right? So for the children, so they daven at like 7 o'clock at night. But then there's like the late, where businessmen have to get it done to the last minute, right? The people who prayed brought Shabbat in at 10:30 at night. So that was like the zip bang service, you know? And sometimes people would actually eat earlier and then just go to the service, and they could work until Shabbat. Which, halachically, technically, is fine. So that's what we did. We went to a movie, the dumb movie, but whatever, it doesn't matter. We went to the movie, and we got home. And as we were coming back to my uncle's, where we were staying, we got off the bus, and we were walking. Weird. Because here I am, and I had grown up as a traditional Jew. And I felt like, you know, like a yuck. I felt like, you know, what am I doing? And even though intellectually I knew, it's not Shabbos yet, it's Friday afternoon, you know, it's not Shabbat, the sun's still up. But they were into Shabbos and I wasn't, and I felt like I'm missing something. And then I started saying to myself, you know, wait a second, is it Shabbat? Is it not Shabbat? I mean, if it is Shabbat, then it is Shabbat. And if it's not, it's not. The seventh day of Shabbat, how can you turn Friday into Shabbos? Rudyard Kipling has an amazing poem. A poem called If.
you've never read it, you should read it. If you can fill the given minute with 60 seconds of long distance run, yours is the earth. Hashem gave us the power over time. He gave us the magic to transform time, to elevate the meaning of time. People will tell you that time is a physical entity. Now, you may have heard that God is above time. What does that mean, God is above time? That's like a nice thing to say when you're having a discussion with someone. What does it mean? So I remember being fascinated by this concept. You know, so you physics study this, study that. You come to the conclusion that time, what is time? What does time measure? Like, I look at my second hand. What is that measuring? What are seconds measuring? What are minutes? So minutes measure hours. What are hours? Well, hours measure rotation in orbit. Time is the measure of movement. Which means that before there was a physical world, before there was movement, there was no time. So if Hashem was before the creation of the physical world as we know it, physical unity, the concept of physical, then it's safe to say that God is above time. And that's a very nice pat explanation that you can put in your box and now you think you understand, right? What Shabbat comes to teach you is that time is not just a measure of movement, because there are different types of movement. It's true, time is the measure of physical movement. But you can change time into the measure of spiritual movement. And a given minute can be a lifetime. And that's the power of Shabbat. So what is it that Moshe is telling the Jewish people? Why does it say, Vayakel Moshe, and Moshe gathers the people together, they're building the tabernacle? There's an unbelievable story there. It says, if I can look up the verse, it says, I think it's in Lamed Vav, in the same portion of Vayakel, right? It says, Rabu Ha'am Lavi, the elders come to Moshe, and they say the people bring too much. Could you imagine any synagogue board in the world doing this? Having a fundraising drive for $1 million, people keep on bringing money. So they announce to them, listen, you've brought enough money. Please don't bring any more money. But that's what the elders do. There's too much. We don't know what to do with all the gold and silver. We should all have such problems. But okay. So Moshe stops everything. He says, okay, everybody stop bringing. Stop, stop, stop. And then they have a discussion about the Mishkan. And then this happens. They gather together about Shabbat. What is that story? What's going on there? So I'll tell you what the Sfat Emet. Sfat Emet was the Gera Rebbe 100 years ago. I mentioned him the other day. His comments are always very cryptic and very short. And there was tremendous depth to that. He says, you know, sometimes you get so into a project that you forget the purpose of that project. You're so involved in what it is that you're doing, you forget why it is that you're trying to do it. That's what was going on here. The Jewish people got all excited because God gave them a project. And don't forget, this is after the big mistake of the golden calf. So it was a wonderful feeling to feel that they had a way to physically rectify it, to do something. They got into this, then they started bringing in. You can picture the Jewish people, they were running back and forth, they're grabbing gold and silver, let's get more. And all of a sudden they're bringing so much. And the elders realize, and with them Moshe, that they've gotten so into the bringing, they've forgotten what they're bringing it for. And Moshe says, stop. You can make the tabernacle of God into an idol. You can make an idol out of anything. And building the tabernacle can become your idolatry if it substitutes itself for that search, that magnificent journey towards what our purpose of existence is. And so Moshe says to them, even when you're building a tabernacle, stop. And appreciate what it's for. And that's what Shabbat is. What is the purpose of this? What is the meaning of it? And I'll tell you one last thought and then this will stop. What does it mean? 6 days you shall work, and the seventh day is to Hashem. There's a big discussion about that. Everybody thinks it means, well, you can do whatever you want for 6 days, but on the seventh day, you can't do all of it. That's not what Judaism suggests. And Maimonides is very clear on this in his Guide to the Perplexed. He says, there's a mitzvah. Now, whether this is a technical one of the 613, that's another question. But it's an imperative that comes from God to work for 6 days. Hashem says, you know, I'm giving you a world. It's not a perfect world. When God creates man, God says, strange thing.
Na'aseh Adam Betzalmenu Kidmutenu. Let us make man in our image. And all the rabbis ask, well, who is God talking to? I mean, this is the sixth day of creation. And God says, let us make man. Who is God talking to? So Rav Soloveitchik, who, as I mentioned to you yesterday, was the teacher of my teachers, says a tremendous thing. God is talking to man. God is saying to humanity, I'm creating you incomplete. I'm creating this world incomplete. Let you and I be partners in finishing the job. Let us make a world together. And that's a tremendous idea. It means, on the one hand, that I'm never alone. That it's difficult to climb as I may think I have. As far a journey as it may be, if I'm doing something, if I'm attempting to struggle with that partnership, Hashem says to us again and again in the Torah, you will never be alone. That's a tremendous idea. But beyond that, it says that I can actually make something of this world. And so Hashem says to me on Friday afternoon, what did you do with my world this week? Sheishet yamim ta'avod. 6 days you should work. 6 days I empower you, says God, to become a creator. To be involved in creative process. Tremendous idea. But there's a danger there. Because the more you create, the more you think you're a creator. And so one day week Hashem says, just remember. Remember it's a partnership. I want you as my partner. But don't forget that I'm the silent partner. Don't forget that I'm with you. Don't leave me out of the loop. Bring me into the business. On the seventh day, I look back and I see what I did with my week. And I dream about what I can do with my next week. That's the power of Shabbat. In fact, that idea encompasses the tapestry of every question you could ever have about Shabbat. Why don't I turn a light switch on Shabbat? Light is a magnificent thing. To be able to turn a switch and to bring light to the world, that we as human beings were able to do that. That's incredible. When you contemplate man's achievements in the last two centuries, it's unbelievable. But at the same time, there's a value in remembering one day a week that that light is not the goal. It's a means. And that I am not ultimately the creator, I am also the created. And so one day a week I contemplate, what is that light? People walk over the light switch, you know. Very often we have in our home, you know, guests come and they're not as aware of Shabbat or whatever it is. So we think, you know, how do you do something so you don't embarrass your guests? That's a very important process to go through. Right? To look at your home, you know, when you have a child. So all of a sudden you look at everything in your house differently when you have your first child. Because all of a sudden the stairs aren't just the stairs. They're dangerous. So you have to baby-proof your home. And if you go to visit someone who doesn't have children, it hits you how un-baby-proofed other homes can be. Well, you can also guest-proof your home. Can you create a home where your guests can't be embarrassed? I have a teacher, a Rav, and they lived in a rented home, and then they moved in a frat, and they built a home. One of the things they did when they built the home was they put soundproof walls on the bathroom. That's a strange thing, because when they had rented an apartment, so the guest bathroom was right off the living room. And you could hear everything the person was doing in the bathroom. So when they built their new home, it was important to them to soundproof the bathroom so that the guests knew that they wouldn't be embarrassed. So you look at Erev Shabbat. How do you prepare for Shabbat? So you make kegel and you put up the candles. And in some homes, you tape the light switches so that nobody should be embarrassed and forget. So you walk over to a house, to a light switch, and you're maybe just starting to develop a relationship with Shabbat, and you've decided, okay, this is something I'm going to try to do. So what do? Right? So, you know, so sometimes it's like a reflex, right? You walk out of a room and it's just like you don't think about it, right? Which is, by the way, one of the values of Shabbat. It teaches you to think about the things you don't normally think about. But okay. And I've seen people, even in the yeshiva world, you know, we forget sometimes. And you walk out of a room, right, and you turn around and go, ooh, right? Which, of course, is kind of dumb because then you've done it twice. So you pull your hand and say, I didn't do it. I didn't turn the light switch on. Of course, that's not true. What do you mean you didn't do it? You just did a world. You just made a speech about who you are and how you see existence and how you want to relate to something beyond. That's a tremendous idea. And every activity that I hold back from in search of a different type of activity is magnificent. And that's the beauty of Shabbat. And you take Shabbat to look back at your week. You know what one of the most special moments in my week is? I sit on Friday night, and there's a beautiful custom, tradition, to bless your children on Friday night. It's a magnificent custom. Matter of fact, I would go so far as to say that if you've never done this, and you're trying to develop a relationship with Shabbat, this is the first thing you should do, before anything else in Shabbat. And if you've never had a blessing from your parents, and your parents are still alive, on a Friday night, call them up on Friday afternoon and tell them you want to bless them. It's a tremendous idea. So I go to each of my children, And I place my hands in the fashion of the priestly blessing on their heads. And there's a Hasidic custom that you actually say the name of the child. Mayan Shifra, Bat Binyamin Moshe, Vitorit Batya, the daughter of me and of my wife, Dorit. And you have an opportunity to bless them. What does that mean? What is a blessing? A blessing is an act of appreciation. It says, I've been given something. So what an incredible moment to appreciate what you've been given. Could you possibly imagine, encompass, define, verbalize this gift of a child? And you start to think about who this child is. And how much this child changed your life this week. And how much this child has given you this week. And how much you dream and hope for this child in the next week. And that's what Shabbat is about. It's a chance to slow down, to think, what do I have in my life? What do I want in my life? What are the things that can really give me meaning? Do I appreciate the things that I already have that can give me meaning? And that's the beauty of Shabbat. So in a few minutes, we're going to take a walk into Mea Shearim, and we'll get to take a look at a traditional neighborhood preparing for Shabbat. And I think part of the challenge will be to try to get a sense of what there is that's there to appreciate, despite obvious differences that we may feel.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.